Well, through Lent, as many of you know already, I've been preaching on the meaning of the cross. The several meanings of the cross, in fact. Because one of the points that is surely becoming clear by now is that there is a whole lot of meaning tucked into this symbol that we aspire to live our lives by. And of course, what's also clear by now is that the writers of the New Testament already understood that very, very well. Through this series, we have been closing in together on some of the dimensions of the cross's meaning that they found particularly significant. How the cross speaks to God's wisdom versus the world's wisdom. How the cross creates healing from woundedness. How it is equally somehow the site of human sin and brokenness, and that gets put together on full display in its full depth of ugliness and outrage, while at the very same time, the cross is also a sign and symbol reminding us that those very same sins have been atoned for, so that the cross is even a more powerful reminder of our freedom and forgiveness. That double-sidedness of the cross, that way in which it holds together before us a reminder in all of these different ways of a broken and ugly side to what it means as well as a redemptive side, is something that I've wanted to focus on especially in this season of Lent. You may remember back a few weeks ago, back to the very beginning of this series, that I asked you to take a fresh look at the cross up there on the front window and imagine that there is a front side and a back side to that cross. A front side with Jesus hanging up, broken, suffering, facing the world back there beyond the shoreline. And a back side, a resurrection side that you and I are being invited to look through and past as we gaze back on that very same world. That's very much, I think, what the New Testament often does with us when it comes to talk about the meaning of the cross, to ask us to consider what that front side and back side have to do with each other and what they have to do with us. Today's scriptures have something interesting to say to us about the cross and God's peaceable kingdom taking shape in the world. Have you ever considered that there are different kinds of peace? Have you ever thought about the fact that all of the things that we call peace aren't all the same or on equal footing with one another? That there is perhaps a worldly kind of peace on the one hand, a broken sort of peace, a front side of the cross sort of peace, versus what we might call a godly peace, an authentic peace, a backside of the cross kind of peace. If we turn to our gospel reading from Luke today, we can see, for example, that there is all kinds of peacemaking happening here. The assembly rises there at the beginning of that reading, and they accuse Jesus, saying, "He's perverting our nation. He's changing our customs around. He's told us not to pay our taxes." Can you believe that? April is coming. He calls himself a king. If only we could get rid of him, we'd have our peace, is what they really seem to be saying. Pontius Pilate is trying to be a peacemaker in his own way. The crowds want a trial. They want a conviction, but Pilate can't see that he's guilty of any kind of crime. And so what does he do when he finds out that Jesus is from Galilee? He punts. Yay! He's from Herod's jurisdiction. Let's let Herod deal with that. That's peacemaking of a kind, you might say, at least temporarily. And then, with Herod, he's anxious and excited to see Jesus at first, but after Jesus won't answer him, the mood turns south. interestingly enough, there's a kind of peace that happens here as well. Peace between the powerful persecutors. Did you notice that that very last verse in our reading from the gospel this morning tells us that after Herod was done with Jesus, it says, quote unquote, that same day, Herod and Pilate became friends with each other. Before that, they had been enemies. There's peacemaking here, all right. It's the peace of kids on the playground who all decide to pick on the same kid in the corner. It's the peace of the politician who just wants to make it to the end of the day in one piece. It's the peace that's forged among the corrupt when they find out they're working towards the same goal. It's peace of a kind. But somehow it lands well shy of what we feel that word must truly mean. It's peace, but it's cynical and self-serving sometimes. It's peace that often comes with a sacrificial victim attached. It's peace in a way, but not really one that shouts, God's kingdom has drawn near. I want to call this false peace, cynical peace, front side of the cross sort of peace. Maybe it's the best that we can come up with under our own power and instincts, but it certainly wears its limitations and its brokenness on its sleeve. Have you ever thought about how often we settle for a front side of the cross definition of peace? Siblings fight with each other for years and years, and then they stop talking to one another for a time, and we let that word peace slide from our tongue as a description of what's happening there. Somewhere in our hearts, I suspect that word settles like a burr in a sock. If a lasting ceasefire began in the Ukraine tomorrow, I'm sure that someone out there on the news somewhere might mistake that for peace. How can a thing with so many unsettled questions and such potential to come undone at a moment's notice really call itself peace? Don't we feel the shortage in our own vocabulary? When the social tensions in our own country and in our world stop bubbling over in the streets for a time, does anyone really want to call that peace with all of those tensions still brimming below the surface? There is, I believe, a front side of the cross sort of peace that we live with in our world, even today, that somehow manages to miss the mark and not measure up to what that word means to a person who's looking back on the world from the other side of the cross. But it does cry out with a question. What do we really mean by peace? What is God really after? What do the pieces of the puzzle that form this gaping hole that we're missing really look like? This is where the Apostle Paul's words from Ephesians really fill in the picture, I think, with a fresh look at the cross that asks us to think about what it means, not just for individual people, but for us as a body, for us as a church, for us as a world full of different people groups who have all been invited to make a common home and find a common peace and identity around the cross. Paul's world in the first century was a socially divided world, just like the world of every century has been. In his orbit, though, of Jews and Gentiles, Jewish Christians versus non-Jewish Christians, that particular dividing line was the main thing that mattered. It was the line around which everyone was divided within the churches of that time. He refers to that here in terms of circumcision versus uncircumcision. He might have also talked about it in terms of whether you were a Christian who kept kosher or not. The point is that there was this massive cultural dividing line and antagonism at times that was dividing up the church. And what Paul has to say here today is that the cross has something powerful to say, not just to us individually, but to the shape of our life together. Not just about your individual forgiveness or your individual redemption, but to who we become together as a people of the cross. He says here in verses 14 and following, He is our peace. In His flesh, He has made both groups into one and has broken down the dividing wall that is the hostility between us. And in verse 16, that He might reconcile both groups to one God in one body through the cross. Two groups of people, socially divided, culturally divided. What those groups believe and what Paul writes to correct is that they really are fundamentally and irreversibly different from one another, down at the core of their very being. And what Paul has to say to them instead is no. No, you're not. No, all of that has been torn down by the cross. On the front side, the cross looks like the kind of cynical, worldly peace that always demands a victim or a scapegoat and allows divisions to continue on intact. But on the redemption side, through the cross, Christ has demolished that cynical kind of peace, making that always come up short. Now Paul writes, He is our peace. The front side of the cross looks like a dead Christ, but Paul tells us that from the backside of the cross, what's really been put to death is the hostility between peoples that divide us up. Beneath the cross on the front side are strangers and aliens. But from the resurrection side, we can see that we are now citizens with the saints and members of the household of God. What God does on the cross of Christ is to make space for an us to really be an us. A radically wide kind of space for a true and a deep sort of reconciliation. Because all of that stuff that we might think lies between us has already been torn down and nailed up to the cross. What would it look like today, I wonder, if Russians and Ukrainians, for example, took a hard look at the cross and realized, as Paul reminds us, that there's no longer any real stuff there anymore that the cross hasn't already addressed? What would it look like in our country, do you think, if peoples of different cultures and colors, of different political leanings, liberals, conservatives, look to the cross in such a way that they could appreciate what the apostle means when he says, He is our peace? Could a church grow up amid those diversities as a witness to the cross against what our culture has reduced us to? What if vaxxers and anti-vaxxers, maskers and anti-maskers took today's look at the cross of Christ and said, you know what? Maybe this whole church thing that Christ is doing in the world and in us is more important than whether we have a piece of paper on our face. Amen? He is our peace. Paul says, in His flesh He has made both groups into one and has broken down the dividing wall that is the hostility between us. Do we really know that, I wonder? I mean, really, do we really know that? Do we really live like we believe that? Have you thought about this look at the cross today that calls the whole church to put things back into perspective? You know, a church that really believes that on the cross, Christ became our peace is a church that gets to experience the tremendous freedom of laying those hostilities down. Wow, what a tremendous freedom. You don't have to keep them up anymore. All that work, bearing that weight, holding that up. You don't have to work so hard to maintain those boundaries anymore. You have an open credit card with a lifetime's supply of peace in the bank. And every time a hostility arises of any kind, you get to pay it down on God's credit card. One cross is enough. The world doesn't need any new scapegoats. We don't have to settle for a front side of the cross kind of peace. Why not just claim the more beautiful and profound peace that's already been made? I don't know about you, but you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go on a spending spree on God's dime. Amen. While the rest of the world is laboring under the weight of its divisions, I'm going to make it rain with the riches that God has provided. Here comes a new reason to get mad and hold a resentment. I'm going to let Christ pay for that one. And meanwhile, I'm going to devote my energies to this wonderful thing that God has bought us. I wonder what it feels like. I wonder where it goes. I wonder if it will unburden our lives and make us lighter on our feet. I wonder if it will put the pieces of our broken hearts back together again. And all of God's people said, Amen.